You might think Grammarly is a fancy spell check, but your team has been using and loving it for years because it does way more than you realize. Grammarly's AI can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
The future may not be clear, but our commitment is. So when you sit with an advisor at Merrill Lynch, we'll put your interests first. Visit ml.com and learn more about Merrill Lynch, an affiliate of Bank of America. Merrill Lynch makes available products and services offered by Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer member, SIPC.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, this was so much fun. I cannot begin to tell you what a delightful time I had. Mark Andreessen of Andreessen Horowitz, an absolute tour de force conversation about everything from valuation to psychological impact of market crashes to are we or are we not in a bubble, the significance of founders and how are you better off with somebody who has people skills but isn't a technologist, or a technologist who doesn't necessarily have the social skills. On and on, we covered so much ground so quickly. Absolutely fascinating. It was an incredible, incredible conversation. It's one of those things where you just say, how privileged am I to sit in a conference room, indeed the conference room where Andreessen Horowitz gets pitched from various startups, and have a 90-minute chat with someone with his just amazing understanding of where tech came from, where it is today, and where it's going. I could babble about this endlessly, but rather than gush, why don't we just listen to the conversation? With no further ado, my podcast conversation with Mark Andreessen of Andreessen Horowitz.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is Mark Andreessen. He is the co-founder and general partner of venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. He comes with a storied background. He co-created the Mosaic Internet browser, co-founded Netscape, sold to AOL for a few billion dollars, co-founded LoudCloud, also sold to HP for a few billion dollars. Crunchbase notes that Andreessen Horowitz has over 500 investments in 321 companies, a number of exits via IPOs and acquisitions. I could go on and on about his curricular vitae, but really he speaks for himself. So let's jump right into this. Mark Andreessen, welcome to Bloomberg Radio, and thank you for hosting us here in Andreessen Horowitz.
I'm thrilled to be on, and it's great to have you here.
I love your facilities. We love all the artwork and everything here. It seems to be like a very civilized place to work.
It's like, I don't know, so being a venture capitalist is like being an airline pilot. Mm-hmm. Long stretches of boredom followed by moments of sheer terror.
Okay.
So we try to have a calm atmosphere.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's go back to the beginning. Your big idea in 1992 was that people would want internet access in their homes. Now, that's a given today. We want internet access wherever we are 24/7. But 25 plus years ago, that wasn't very obvious. What led you to say in 1992, I have an idea, an internet browser?
Yes, I would say it was even beyond not obvious. It was considered ridiculous. So the idea that basically it was well known in 1992 that the internet was for academics and nerds, mm-hmm. and that there was no use case for ordinary people. Like, it was just incomprehensible. Like, how would anybody even have the technical capability to even consider
right.
getting online, much less have anything that they could do productively mm-hmm. once they're online. I've since actually, in the years since, I've actually learned a principle that I have generalized out that it explains what happened, which is William Gibson, the famous science fiction author, wrote Neuromancer. Mm-hmm. It was a very influential book in our industry. He says his line is the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. And there are
many applications to that line.
Yeah, that's
too,
exactly right.
It's such a fabulous insight.
Yeah. And so the new ideas, this is something I've really come to believe, is the new ideas already exist. There are a few ideas that actually materialize out of thin air. They generally already exist somewhere, and they exist somewhere in a lab, right? They exist somewhere in a fringe group or in an underground movement or something like that. And so what happened here was, and this is the part that's just, I think, probably pure luck, is I went to college at University of Illinois, which at that time was one of four universities in the country that had been funded by the government to be the hubs for what at the time was called the NSFNet, mm-hmm. which was what became the internet. And there's a whole program developed in the 80s around supercomputers, and this is what when Al Gore claimed credit for creating the internet, this is what he was talking about, was the funding for this program to wire these universities. And so we had on campus in 1993 the level of broadband that people have in their homes today, mm-hmm. And we had the use, you saw the use cases, you saw everybody using all this stuff. Now it wasn't at the level of sophistication as today, but you could see all the use cases, and you could see how much people liked it. But the expectation was you had it in college, and then you would graduate, and you would go off into life, and you would just give it up.
Right.
And that was the part where I was like, uh-uh.
NSFNet was after DARPANET, but before full-on internet for the public. Is that a fair explanation?
Yeah, that's right. So ARPA was known as ARPA, now known as DARPA, funded a military network, which was originally conceived as a way to do nuclear command and control in the event of bad things happening in the world. Therefore, the importance of packet switching.
Had to be able to respond even after you've been attacked by a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, you've got a network with 100 nodes, and then 20 of them get wiped out by attack. You still have to have, the network has to still keep running, and traditional mm-hmm. networks don't keep running, and at least in theory, packet switch networks can keep running. So that was, and this is like 50 years ago, they all figured this stuff out. And then in the 80s, that idea got generalized out to the idea that civilian researchers should be able to use this technology. In particular, actually, the government was funding these national supercomputer centers. They were buying these super expensive supercomputers to put on four or five college campuses. And then they wanted to provide access to scientists from all over the country to be able to access those. And so they basically took the template of ARPANET and turned it into NSFNet.
And allowed anybody with permission to log into those computers, have temporary time. You would have a few minutes or hours, whatever it was. And that's eventually where led to the full-on internet. Let's talk about the other name in Andreessen Horowitz, Ben Horowitz. You guys have been working together for a long time. Have you made that partnership work, and how did it really begin? Because if what I've read is to be believed, some of it started out a little rocky.
Ben took great delight in his book in describing the origins of the relationship. So at this point, we're an old married couple.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the good news is we can finish each other's sentences. I guess mm-hmm. the bad news is we usually try to finish each other's sentences.
Okay.
So we've had a long running partnership and friendship for a very long time now, 22 years, I guess. The origin of it actually is, so he was one of the early guys actually to jump into Netscape early on when Netscape was still a radical idea. Mm-hmm. He actually came over from Lotus, which at the time was this big, important, dominant software company.
Eventually bought by IBM.
Actually, fun story about IBM. IBM, after he left, IBM bought Lotus for, I think, $3.5 billion at the time, which was a blockbuster deal. In retrospect, had IBM spent $3.5 billion, they could have bought the entire internet.
That's amazing.
Instead of Lotus. They could have bought every internet company and every ISP, and they could have owned the whole thing. So anyway, he saw the future.
Not the first time IBM missed a boat.
Yes.
What is it? Probably won't be the last.
Big companies, yeah. We all at some point tend to do that. But I think to his credit, he saw the future. He saw what was going to happen. I mean, even more clearly than a lot of other people who were involved back then. And so he jumped over. Netscape was a very short ride, but it was very intense. It was a pressure cooker. And so it was very easy to see internally who was high potential and who wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had him on a very fast promotion path, basically, from the day he joined. And I think had we
stayed... High potential. Is that the phrase you used?
Yeah, high potential. Basically, you're always trying in these organizations to find the young managers who you think are going to be able to scale and grow and eventually become the leaders of the company, mm-hmm. right? And so I think had Netscape stayed independent, we sold the company in 1998, but had we stayed independent, I think he would have ended up as the CEO at some point.
Hmm.
He was just still very young at that point, but it was just very clear how smart he was and how good of a leader he was and how good his judgment was. And so after we sold the company, we then had the opportunity to start a new company, and it became clear that we wanted to work together.
So let's talk about Jim Clark.
Yeah.
I always kind of knew who Jim Clark was, but then Michael Lewis's The New Thing is what really teed up Jim Clark for me. Yeah. What was that like, meeting Jim Clark? How did you guys start to work together?
Yeah, so Jim, that was, again, probably a stroke of luck in my career. Jim called me one day.
Out of the blue, out of left field.
Well, so a friend of his, an associate of his who he had worked with, so he had been the founder of this company called Silicon Graphics, which at the time had a reputation similar to Google's reputation today. It was considered the sort of the gold standard Silicon Valley company that all the great engineers wanted to work for. It was very much, this is when, the, after the movie Terminator 2 came out, and they were redefining this whole idea of 3D special effects, and they were it was just this kind of amazing moment for this company. But he left for a variety of reasons and decided he wanted to start a second company. And so this is a little bit like Larry Page leaving Google or Mark Zuckerberg leaving Facebook,
right,
saying, I need to start a new company. And then, but he had hired everybody he knew who was smart, who he had ever worked with, into Silicon Graphics. And so they weren't available to start a new company with him. And so he literally needed fresh people. So he got together with a group of friends and basically made a list of people who were in the industry who he had not yet worked with. And he it culminated in a list of about a dozen people who he approached at various stages and said, you know, do you want to consider doing something together? Which culminated in a big dinner in Palo Alto with like the full dozen of us. And then at the end of the whole process, I was the only one left standing.
Really? Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, by the way, it wasn't because necessarily, I think he knocked some of the others out of the process, but also a lot of people, they were just like, they had jobs.
They were committed. They weren't willing to take yet another leap.
And this was a pretty, also people forget, like 93, 94, we started Netscape in 94. It was a very similar mood in the Valley then to what happened 10 years later after the .com crash. It was a very dark time in the Valley. The Valley had a severe economic crash in 89, 90, 91, and was still kind of in the doldrums in 92, 93, 94. So the idea of a startup was considered kind of a radical thing and potentially a dangerous thing from a career standpoint. And so it wasn't the most obvious thing in the world for people to leap into the new thing. And then in contrast, I had just arrived out of college. I had nothing to lose.
You had no baggage. You were ready to go. So I always have this vision of the reason Netscape led to this explosion of new technologies. At the time, Microsoft pretty much was the only game in town, and very often I just envisioned young guys with great ideas going to venture capitalists, and every pitch meeting someone ends up saying, what prevents Microsoft from building this into their operating system? And if you didn't have an answer to that, well, thanks for coming by, see you later. And Netscape allowed everybody to say, hey, we could bypass the operating system and do this online.
Yeah.
Am I remotely close to that early 90s understanding of who was then the dominant software player?
Yeah, so strategically, I think that's right, and that was a big effect. But I would say there was an equal kind of effect at the same time that was at least as important, which was it unlocking the potential of the people in the Valley. So the most astonishing thing to me was, I mean, because the internet, like I said, the internet stuff was not, we started Netscape, like this was not considered like, oh yeah, this is a great idea. Most people were like, okay, this is nutty. Like everybody knows, it was common thing. Everybody knows you can't make money on the internet. There's no way to do it. Commercial activity on the internet was actually illegal until 1993, right? It actually was not permitted because it was federally researched.
Oh, so this is before the days of .com. It was just .edu?
.edu. But you could have .com, but you couldn't do anything commercial. You couldn't do transactions. There was these called acceptable use limits because it was federally funded, and they hadn't legalized it yet. So we started Netscape kind of right as they switched it. So, but it was widely viewed as, number one, it's illegal. And then number two, even if it were legal, people wouldn't want to do it because you can't trust the internet. There's hackers and thieves and all this stuff, and it's just not something, and then ordinary people just won't do this. And so it was very counterintuitive. Within a year, though, like by 1995, when the sort of conventional wisdom, people started to get exposed to it, and they started to have it in their lives, and they started to say, oh, wow, I actually like this, and this starts to make more sense. There was then this amazing flood of talent, where all these incredibly sharp people in Silicon Valley who had worked on previous generations of technology over the previous 20 years, it turned out they were still here, right? And they were either at the older companies or they were just parked, you know, kind of on the beach. And all of a sudden there was a new thing, and they just all showed up out of nowhere. And so it was like this materialization of human capital and talent basically out of thin air. And I was just astonished to see these incredibly talented people coming in, engineers, marketers, salespeople, and then all the other people who need to make a company go, HR people and lawyers and all these people, finance people, they just show up. And all of a sudden you've got this company that's like fully up and running with all these people with all these skills and experiences that I didn't even think was possible.
Well,
and this is the magic of the Valley. I mean, this is the people side of the magic of the Valley, is the human capital. Well, the people will flow into the next opportunity much more aggressively than you'll find, I think, anywhere else in the world.
So when you say they just show up, in my mind's eye, You have Stanford, you have Berkeley, you have all these great universities nearby, Caltech. You have a history of companies going back to Fairchild Semiconductor and what have you, right. Plus a lot of defense and NASA-related stuff. So you would envision it's almost like all the parts are there just waiting for something to crystallize it and send everybody off. So I've always looked at this as – this is kind of a magic, one of the magic parts of the country. And Boston is similar and D.C. is similar. And now Seattle has it and to a lesser degree Portland has that same sort of once you get a critical mass of human capital, well, all bets are off. Who knows where this goes?
Yeah, that's right.
Although you seemingly have known where this was going to go before many other people.
In some cases, but not in others.
What was your – so to get back to the original question about Michael Lewis's new thing, I assume you read the book. Yeah. Did you enjoy it? Did it ring true? Do you recognize a lot of the characters in it, even people you may not necessarily know?
I would say it captured a moment in time, which was sort of the top of the dot-com bubble, and then it captured a part of Jim's personality, which is the ability to kind of materialize new ideas out of thin air into existence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it captured, in fairness to Jim, I don't think it captured his depth as much as I – so
– that's hard to do.
It's very hard to do. So Jim specifically – so Jim and the book tells a lot of his life story. He had a very, very interesting background, but it culminated ultimately in the Navy and so forth, but it ultimately culminated in – he had a PhD in computer science from the University of Utah, which was actually the creation origin point for a lot of the things in our industry today. Actually,
Utah.
There was something special that happened at University of Utah in the 60s and 70s. Basically all of computer graphics and video games and all this stuff and all the stuff that led to SGI ultimately, it was all kind of conceived. The ideas were conceived actually at Utah at that time. Like Pixar, it all, if you'd like trace Pixar back, it all flows back to this moment in time at the University of Utah. And so anyway, so he had a PhD in CS and then he went to Stanford and he was a professor at Stanford, right? And then he decided the life of an academic was not.
Right. You know, academics don't have the largest yacht in the world and he was building one of the largest sailing vessels.
Yeah.
I think he wanted to play a little more than he wanted to teach, or at least that's my take.
Oh,
from
so
the
this
book.
Is part of the thing, also that it, yeah, he, so that ended up becoming a big part of the book. But I would, and then again, I would just say what was missed was when I worked with Jim, and other people who have worked with Jim will tell you, like he goes just as deep as he goes broad. Like he is very deeply in the details of technology. He's not. The book makes it, I think, come across like he kind of glosses over the details and leaves those to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I did not find it to be the case. Like he's incredibly deep on technology. He's an incredibly comprehensive thinker on all aspects of business. Like he goes really, really deep. It's just that's not quite as it's not quite as sexy for the book, I guess.
Right.
It captured part of his personality, but it didn't capture the depth and the seriousness and the application and his role really as a primary inventor and inventor not just of ideas, but inventor of actual technologies. And then also, by the way, as a recruiter, he's one of the great all time people who can gather other people around them. And he's really good at painting a picture. Because he's so deep in the technology, he carries tremendous. There's a lot of people who are promotional, right? A lot of people will show up and they'll say, we're going to do X, Y, Z. And the engineers will be like, well, you don't like what, you know, where did you go to school? Like, what's your professional credential to be able to have this concept? And why do you think we're just going to do all this for you? Whereas with Jim, he's like an actual technology legend, right? Who probably knows more about the topic than you do. And so he paints the picture and then he gets buy-in from people, incredible, amazing people.
So
there's just he has a level of seriousness and capability that I think is just way beyond what Michael was able to paint in that book.
So the Netscape IPO is 95, 96, something like
so
that?
So we went public, so we went public 18 months after founding in 1995.
I remember that because I was a junior trader. I was the little guy on the desk and it was just a day of mayhem.
Right.
And that really started a run of technology and internet companies for the next few years.
Yeah.
What was that ride like? That had to be insane.
Yeah, no, it was crazy, like being shot out of a rocket. Like, and not just me, like the whole valley had that experience. And so, it really was. It was what you mentioned. It was the establishment of a new platform. It was the establishment of this kind of new frontier. It was the idea that all of a sudden there were these thousands of new businesses that could get created on top. It was this idea all of a sudden that people are connected. It's actually really striking. If you look, so the dot-com crash right hit in 2000, and then all these ideas that were viewed then as all the dot-com ideas that were viewed as genius in 1998 were viewed as just complete lunacy and idiocy in 2000.
Pets.com, right? Doesn't make any sense.
Being the classic example, right? So it's actually really striking. All of those ideas are working today. I can't think of a single idea from that era that's not working today. And the kicker to the pets.com story is there's a company, Chewy, that just got bought for over $3 billion, right, out of Florida, which is online pet food sales, like 2 weeks ago, Right. And so even online pet food sales turns out to be a gigantic and very successful business. And so basically the community, the tech community, the Silicon Valley community, the global community that got connected to the internet very quickly between 1995 and call it 1998 actually came up with all the ideas. Like they all, people are very creative. And all of a sudden there was just like, this, if you read, you know, remember, you may remember there was a magazine back then called the Industry Standard.
Sure.
Which became kind of the defining kind of Bible of the time. And if in, there was a period where if you read the Industry Standard after the crash, you're just like, oh, these people were just all high. Like this. This is just nuts. If you read it today, it's like a direct forecast of what's actually happening.
Right.
Today. Like all the stuff actually is happening. It's all working.
So,
and so it was an amazing unleashing of talent and creativity and ideas interrupted by a very bad crash. But it has since, all those ideas have since really come true.
What, one of the things I'm always hearing about is how, well, this is just like the dot-com era. The valley is booming. This all ends badly. But right. when we, this week we've been in everywhere from Berkeley to Palo Alto to Pleasanton to Mountain View. This looks to me much more like a robust economy than, hey, this is completely unhinged and it's a train wreck waiting to happen. You lived through the last version of the dot-com bubble. How is this time so different in nature? The obvious thing is a lot of these companies are actually making money.
Yeah. Yeah, some of them are making a lot of money. So, mm-hmm. In fact, now the accusation is they're making too much money, which is the criticism from the other side. So,
that just means they're efficient and productive. It doesn't mean anything is wrong.
Exactly. So, yes, from your lips to God's ears. So, so I guess I'd say the economists actually, there's a theory actually in economics on this, which the economists called the depression baby effect, mm-hmm. Which is basically there's been studies, papers written about this. If you Google depression babies, it'll pop up. Investors who were in the stock market in 1929 never went back into the stock market. They stayed out of the stock market for the rest of their lives because 1929 proved definitively, right, that stocks are fundamentally unsafe.
And if you look at the chart of it, literally from 1929, you don't get back to break even till 1954. It's 25 years later. It's a full generation has to be born, grow up, get jobs, and start investing in order for the market to get above that 29
that's
peak.
Right. Exactly. With no memory. You need investors with
right.
no memory.
That's exactly right.
And then by the 25 years, exactly right. And then the other kicker is it takes another 15 years after that to get another actual bubble. Right? Mm-hmm. The next stock market bubble did not materialize until the late 60s. The full 40 years.
Nifty right? 50, 1966, right. The Dow hits 1,000. It's not over it for another 16 years.
Yeah.
Quite amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, the point is if you live through one of these scarring crashes, mm-hmm. you get psychologically marked. You get traumatized. And by the way, the you there is everybody, right? It's not just the investors, it's also the people who follow the market, it's also people who write mm-hmm. about the market, it's also people who work at the companies. Everybody gets traumatized. And so we had and have an entire generation of depression babies, including me, right? In Silicon Valley who went through 2000. That's significant for a couple of reasons. One is just, I would argue that, right, the narrative basically since 2004 has been it's bubble 2.0. I think exactly the opposite. It's been a long-term bust.
Right.
I think tech stocks have been undervalued sort of consistently basically since 2002, 2003, and even to this day are probably undervalued relative to where they should be valued. We can come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other thing that's happening is now finally enough time is passing. It's now we're coming, you know, 17 years since the crash. So now finally we're getting enough kids coming to the Valley who don't have a memory of the crash.
They don't have post-crash traumatic stress disorder.
They were like in fourth grade.
Right.
And so they were like busy with Legos. Like they just, mm-hmm. it's not a relevant concept. And so when you get these weird conversations, we find ourselves in these conversations where you're telling these cautionary tales, right, of what happened in 1998 or 1999, and they just look at you like grandpa. Like, right. You know, tell us about the Model T. Like, right. It's just an absurd kind of thing. And by the way, it's not that there's a good or a bad, it's just people have different life experiences. But my point is like the balance is shifting. And you have this new generation of people in the Valley who are just like, let's just go build things. Like, let's not be held back by the superstition of what happened. Let's go build new things.
Mm-hmm.
And then to your point, like these things have worked. When we were building Netscape in 97, 98, the maximum addressable market size for our company was 50 million internet users, of which
right.
most were on dial-up and all were tethered to their desktop PCs, which were super slow and crude compared to mm-hmm. today. And now, as you know, you have 3 billion people with smartphones and mobile broadband in the world on its way to 6 billion. And so like this stuff is working. Like it actually came true.
The fascinating thing, every time when the NASDAQ regained its 2000 peak not too long ago, people said, here we are, it's going to crash again. And you look, I always look at those folks and say, well, wait a second. That was an infinite PE. You now have companies actually not just making money, but making boatloads of money. And it's 15 years later. Yeah. So whatever the problems were then, how do you just assume at this price level, it's the same thing? clearly something very different is going on today.
Yeah.
So sticking with that point, when you hear people saying Silicon Valley is in a bubble again, look at all these unicorns, here comes the train wreck, do you just kind of shrug to yourself? What's your reaction to that?
So those have been the headlines for, excuse me, every year since 2004. So 2004. So 2004.
Hey, they'll get it right eventually. Just keep saying the same thing over and over again.
2004. Granted, 2001 to 2003 were very bad. So fully granted. 2004, there were two M&A events. Yahoo bought two companies for $25 million each, Flickr and Delicious. And that created the bubble 2.0 narrative. But in other words, like if anything in tech works, and if any company in tech ever succeeds, it's therefore obviously evidence of
a bubble. It's a bubble, of course.
Right. And so that's been the narrative the entire time. We've done decks on this. We have decks on our website. Like we've done detailed analytics on every aspect of the financial numbers and the flows of money and the whole thing. And you go through the whole thing. And when you do the analysis, I think correctly, like just objectively correctly, it's just crystal clear how out of control everything got really between 1998 and 2000 and how relatively placid it's been ever since. But people don't, you know, it's the kind of thing. People just have a very strong emotional response. It's a depression baby effect. People have an emotional response. Right. The emotional response is I got tricked once. I'm not going to get tricked again.
Right.
And so it's led to this continuous, in my view, underestimation of what's happening. Right. It's led to the opposite problem, which is people are really deeply, if they were overestimating what was happening in 98, they're underestimating it. And they're still underestimating it today.
Which makes sense.
Which is why I say the stocks are, everything's probably still undervalued.
Which makes sense. If you come out after that experience and you are negatively tinged with that, gee, I got burned last time because valuations didn't make sense. Fast forward 15 years, that doesn't leave these folks. So that permanently colors, and there, you know, other related studies, people graduate college into a recession. It not only affects their earnings power over the course of their lifetime, it affects their philosophical outlook. Yeah, they are actually biased and expect recessions to occur more often than they actually do.
Yeah, that's right.
It's our wetware is kind of deeply flawed. So you're a builder. You've created a couple of companies, including this one. In your mind's eye, are you a founder, or are you a venture capitalist, or a little bit of both?
So I think of myself as an engineer first, and everything else after that. And so it's kind of the core. And you never know how much of this is self-delusion, of course. But I think of myself.
My assumption is we're all self-delusional, and occasionally, if you glimpse a little reality, fantastic.
And they either work for you or they don't. So I was trained as an engineer. I was always had sort of an engineering mindset, and then I was trained as an engineer, trained at a great engineering school. And so I always view myself. I'm just trying to figure out how things work, and then try how to make them work better. And I'm far more interested in figuring that out than in trying to draw value judgments on them or trying to have other kinds of debates around them. And so that's just been the core of the thing. And so to the extent that my companies have worked, it's because they built products that people wanted. To the extent that this firm works, it's because we're finding those products and the people who build those products early and betting on them. And so it's sort of engineering is the core discipline. And then we are lucky enough, in my view, to live in a system in which, that rewards that skill in the sense of people can build things. Right. People can build things. They're encouraged to build things. They're culturally encouraged to build things. And those things might be new products, but those things also might be new companies.
Back in 2011, you wrote a fascinating screed called Software is Eating the World. Not only did it end up becoming a meme that went fairly viral, it turned out you were not just a little bit right. You were very right. Tell us about what motivated you to put those words on paper.
Yeah, so it was a two-part attempt. One was to explain what was actually happening, and actually a lot of it was actually against the bubble narrative. The new bubble narrative was so strong at that point that I wanted to articulate a view of what was happening that was not just this is all a bunch of hot air. So it was partially explanatory, but also an attempt to forecast. And specifically in the piece, I sort of lay out a forecast for the future in three parts, which I think is the part that kind of remains, the section that remains provocative today, the three parts. Maybe I can recap those real quickly. So part one is every product or service that can become software will become software. And there's a long conversation we can have about it. That's the big theme of what's happening in Silicon Valley right now, I think, is that we are now going after entire industries that used to be dominated by just like retail, retail storefronts or 1-800 numbers or.
So is this appification or is this just the move to pure software?
Well, appification is the consumer experience, right? Which is everything that can be experienced as an app. If you want a mortgage, it should be an app. Right? You want life insurance, it should be an app. You want to order pizza, it should be an app. Like everything should just happen through that front end. But it's deeper than the app because because it's the complete back, it's all the back end systems of software that make the economy ultimately work. So part one, every product or service that can become software will. Part two, therefore, every company that makes those products or services has to and will become a software company, right? So companies will become more and more defined by building software, just like, and Silicon Valley companies are already like this. Silicon Valley companies are software companies first that then get good at things like sales and marketing, right? Whereas in the rest of the economy, you have a lot of companies that are good at sales and marketing that are trying to bolt on software.
Right.
But sitting here 10 years from now, all these companies are going to be software companies first because they're going to have to be.
That's fascinating.
The form of the product. And then the third sort of most either provocative, arrogant, you know, or delusional principle is therefore in any industry in the long run, the winning company will be the best software company. Right. So whoever's the best.
Is that really all that? The follow-up question is how much pushback did your original writing get? And are you still getting pushback on that third part of it?
Well, that third one is very provocative. So let me give an example.
But it's pretty. It follows logically. Okay. It's if you believe in deductive reasoning, it makes sense.
Well, let's pick a particularly provocative example. Cars, right? Mm-hmm. So cars. Obviously, cars. There's a lot more software in cars than there was 10, 20 years ago. Everybody knows that. It's a step further to say that in 10 years, the winning car company is going to be the car company that makes the best software, right? There's no existing legacy car company in the world today that would say that that's the case, right? They would all say that they are best at making cars and that the software is a component that goes in the cars. But the whole point of being a car company is to be great at engineering the actual physical automobile, the steel and the rubber and all the safety systems and the whole thing.
Well, but if you believe self-autonomous vehicles are coming, that's software.
Exactly right. Right. And so that would be our thesis is that, no, what's actually going to happen is the value will flow to the software layer. The entire experience of being in a car will be defined by the software. And then at the limit, whichever company that makes cars or makes the intellectual property that goes into cars, whichever of those creates the best software will then be the winning company. And we'll get the majority of the value, right? Including ultimately the majority.
So what you're really describing is the iPhone. Yeah, this is manufactured in China. I believe they make about $5 per phone building it together. Yeah. And then this little company, you may know them. They're up the street in Cupertino. Yeah. Apple is the one that captures not only all the value from the iPhone, but pretty much all of the profits from the entire, or 90% of the profits from the entire mobile universe. Yeah. Is that the same basic concept? Yeah. Is it an iPhone model for everything else, including automobiles?
So in general, yes. That's the implication, right? And that's the exact analogy, by the way, that the car industry is grappling with right now, which is as you know, in phones, you used to have these companies like Nokia and RIM and others that made phones and viewed software as just this kind of add-on top of the hardware. But the hardware.
I'm not that old. I don't really remember those companies, right?
I know. And so, you know, when car CEOs now, they're all thinking, like, they're working on this. The new generation of car CEOs, they're working on
this
very
hard,
and they're spending a lot of time out here, and they spend a lot of time with us, and they're working hard on it. But literally, the way they frame that question is, we existing car company do not want to be the Nokia of cars,
Nokia of cars.
That analogy is very front and center in their thinking. Now, at one level of detail lower than that, the iPhone is a particular success case of vertical integration. Apple does the, they don't manufacture every component in it, but they assemble the whole thing.
Hardware, software, app store.
Services all coupled together. Sometimes the winner is vertically integrated. There are other times in other industries, and PCs were like this, the other example, which is horizontal in structure. And so the other outcome is you'll have, for example, a Microsoft of cars, right, where you'll have the software layer that actually ends up, and they actually, in that model, they, instead of making the car, that winning company might just sell its software to all the car companies. But then it's like the relationship that Microsoft ended up having with all the PC companies, right, where the PC companies did all the work of actually making and selling the PC, and Microsoft got all the money.
Right.
And so the victory for the best software company could go either vertical or horizontal, and that varies a lot. But I believe the consistent theme will be the company with the best software will, exactly your point, they'll end up getting most of the profits.
So
and have the strategic control, right? They'll be able to dictate the future of the industry by virtue of the fact that they control the software.
So that naturally leads to the question, is Tesla an electric car manufacturer, or is Tesla a software company that happens to make a pretty good looking car as well?
Yeah. That's right. So this is the thing. If you squint with, and by the way, I mean, Elon is deservedly a legend, and so nothing I'm about to say should be interpreted as a criticism of Elon, but just from a historic sweep of history standpoint, if you squint at Tesla one way, it looks like Apple circa 2007, 2008, where they release the iPhone. They just haven't sold very many yet, but they're going to sell a ton.
Right.
And they're going to be the vertical winner a la Apple. Another way of looking at Tesla is, you know, they're Apple in 1992 with Macintosh. And yes, their integrated hardware software is good, but other people are going to come up with software as well. And then there are many other people who make cars. And so, you know, the whole thing may just, you know, they may set the mode for what other people end up doing at much higher scale. And I think that's the big question on Tesla is like, is which way does that tip? Obviously, Elon's highly determined to make sure that he owns the whole stack. And to your point, he's incredibly focused on software. Like he is Tesla is deeply, deeply immersed in the details, not just by the way of the software that obviously runs the car, but for example, power management is a big, a secret advantage
right.
of Tesla. People don't talk about that much is they buy the batteries from somebody else, but they write the software that manages the power, which is a big part of getting the range.
And the ludicrous mode.
Yeah, and the ludicrous mode. And then they're also, he's now deeply involved in building this, making sure that Tesla, he's going to try to have Tesla be the best self-driving car, right? Which is entirely a software exercise. And so he's on it. Like he's pushing very hard. And then the other car companies are all in, you know, more or less reactive mode to what he's
catch
doing.
Catch up,
so
right.
He definitely has the lead right now. But that said, the other car companies are trying to figure this out. And we now have an entire wave of new automotive software companies in Silicon Valley. Right. There's dozens on its way to hundreds of highly capable founders and engineers building new kinds of autonomous software for cars. By the way, vehicles of all different size, shape, and description, air vehicles, ground vehicles, water vehicles. Right. So there's a revolution afoot of which Tesla is an important part, but it's also become much broader now.
Quite fascinating. In the early 1990s, I keep coming back to that era when venture capitalists were funding startups. People had to go out and buy their own servers. They had to have engineers to manage that and build that. And there was a giant infrastructure. It would take tens of millions of dollars just to open a company. Today, that stuff is, if not free, well, certainly very cheap with Amazon Cloud Services and a whole huge infrastructure. So if you want to launch a company today, it doesn't take $10 million just to open the doors. You could really do things on the cheap. How does that shift in infrastructure change your job as a venture capitalist when you're looking at companies? What do they really need? Do we really need to give people $20, $30, $40 million at a pop when they could start for a few thousand dollars?
Right. So that's exactly right. That's exactly what's happened. And we think about that in economic terms as a very rapid deflation of input costs, right? So, which is dramatic. It's like the inflation input, the input costs for a startup in economic terms have deflated by a factor of like 1,000 over the course of 15 years, which is amazing, right? It's hard to actually find a historical precedent for that happening.
Where it used to cost $10 million just to launch, and now you could do it for a few grand.
We routinely get, you know, we'll get three or four kids in here. Their entire CapEx, the entire company is their laptops, right? That's it. That's all they have.
It's like $4,000 and they're good to go.
That's it. They're good to go. Everything else is like, it's $100. They have a $100 bill this month on their MX for their Amazon Cloud Services to launch the thing and see if it works. And so that's a dramatic step change. That's huge. I mean, it's very hard to find any precedent for that, which is a big reason why so much energy has come back to the Valley. So as a VC, what that results in is the Darwinian process of running experiments to surface the good ideas and the good companies is now happening at much higher scale and at a much faster pace, right? And so as a VC, this is amazing.
It's not just the pace of acceleration. The second derivative is increasing also. It's accelerating at a faster and faster rate.
Yeah, well, number one is just the sheer number of ideas that can be explored has gone way up, right? Because there's elasticity. The less it costs to test a new idea, the more new ideas will get tested.
Sure.
And more people will try to test new ideas. And then, right, the second is it's just so much faster now. It's just the speed to get to market is just so much faster.
How do you deal with that? How do you sift through a near infinite amount of really fantastic and interesting ideas?
So that's the business. And so the day-to-day business is we evaluate 2,000 referred high qualified startups a year every year. So that's the day job here is to sort and sift and filter through the 2,000.
And of 2,000, how many do you end up doing? Now you also do something unusual. You do sort of angel funding at a very modest level and then broader funding for more, I guess we would say, developed or advanced companies. So out of those 2,000 that get reviewed, what does it break down to?
Right now it's about 30 a year.
30 a year.
About 30 a year out of 2,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I could go through in detail but exactly where. But like that's basically the rate, so a little bit more than 1%. By the way, I should also say these are 2,000 that are referred, right? So these are sent to us. There's some connectivity to people we know.
So I can give you an elevator pitch now.
Now that you're here. In fact, you're in the room.
Give me a few minutes. I'll think up a business model.
This is the actual room for that. So 2,000 a year, and then the other side of it is it's not just, right, the whole thing with this is it's not just is it it a good idea or a good product, it's also who are the people, right? Because these are people, at the end of the day, these are people businesses. And so honestly, most of what we're doing is evaluating people.
So that was always a question that I find intriguing. Very often these ideas come along, there's no patents on them. There's almost something in the ether where a lot of people get very similar ideas. How often do we see four or five different companies in the same space? Hey, there's Uber and Lyft, and there's Pandora, and go down the list. And every time you look at a concept, it looks like a lot of people have said, hey, you know what would be cool right about now? How do you figure out who has not just the best idea, but the best way to execute it when you're dealing with some really young, inexperienced technologists who very often have no business experience, either just out of grad school, sometimes dropping out of college? That sounds like a near impossible decision-making process.
Yeah, yeah. So we call this the volcano movie problem. There's never just one movie about volcanoes. There's always two or three or four or five.
At the same. Right.
Never two giant. There's never just one
deep
giant,
impact
giant
and,
robot movie. There's never two killer. There's never just one killer meteor movie. So there's got to be two. So yeah. So that's a thing. And these ideas, they come in waves. And so that's exactly what happens. So the thing that we try to go. I mean, there's a lot of different lenses you apply to when you're evaluating people. But one of the ones we really dig into hard to try to pull kind of what we call kind of the real founders away from the people who just like think they have an idea and how to try something. So the concept we call the idea maze, one of our partners, Crystallized, wrote a paper on Balaji Srinivasan called the idea maze. And so the idea maze is, it appears on the surface, ooh, look, this is a cute idea. Like, and by the way, lots of people have this idea. The real founders, the really good ones, what you find is they have thought about the problem so deeply and for so long that they have worked their way through the logic maze of how to try the idea and what they're going to try next if it doesn't work and what the implications would be if they learn something. And who are the people they need to bring into the company, and how do they segment the market, and how do they go acquire the customers? And so all these details, it's all the topics in sort of that you don't cover in the first hour of the meeting, but you cover in the subsequent 5 hours when you go really deep, right, with them. And the really good founders tend to all have in common is they've been all the way through the idea maze on their own before they've come in and talked to a VC. Mm-hmm. So there is not ideally in the best case, there's not a question that we can ask them in the meeting in the first 6 hours of discussion that they haven't already. Not only have they already thought of the question, they've already figured out the answer for themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. In fact, you actually get to the point with the really good, the really sharp ones get to the point where they get frustrated because they're like, why is this not all obvious to you people? Like, this is, why are you asking me all these stupid questions? I figured this out 2 years ago. Like, I already know the, like,
this and is it should be self-evident to everybody.
It should be self-evident to everybody because they figured the whole thing out.
Right.
As contrasted, by the way, to the ones who haven't done that, if somebody's only put, 10 or 20 hours into thinking through something and they just decided to put together a pitch, it becomes crystal clear because you get 8 or 10 or 12 questions in and they stop being able to answer the questions.
Now you just
start making up the answers.
So you just revealed this. Are you at all concerned that people would come in and say, okay, now I have all my ducks lined up and Mark isn't going to throw me off my pitch?
Well, they try to trick us already. So if they haven't been through the idea maze, they try to convince us they have been, but they just start making up the answers, right?
And that's obvious.
You can flesh that out. Like you can figure that out. You can. It's part of body language, in part just content. Like they just can't back up their answers. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a little bit like how police do interrogations. So the way if you're ever getting interrogated by a cop and he thinks you're, what he just does is the questions get more and more detailed.
Right.
Oh, your alibi is you were out seeing a movie that night. Okay, well, what movie? Well, what was the opening scene? Right. Well, what was the plot twist at the end? What snack did you have? Oh, you had popcorn. Oh, did you have salt in your popcorn or not? And they just go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until you finally freak out because you can't make up all these details.
Right.
So it's the same kind of thing. And so the reason why I say it so openly is it would be good for us if more founders actually went through the full idea maze. It would be great for us if more founders came in here having thought much more deeply about what they're doing. And this is part of where the popular narrative of startups is probably a little bit problematic. The popular narrative of startups is, it's like the popular narrative of an invention is that these are somehow eureka moments.
Right.
It's just sudden flash of brilliance, and and by the way, these companies all have these origin myths, like, oh, I was just a kid doing this and this idea came to me and lo and behold, boom, Facebook, right? and that's not at all how it works, right? It's this incredibly deep and elaborate process of thinking and work that actually leads to these things happening. And so I think for people to be able, if more founders understand the concept of the idea maze and they set the bar higher for themselves and the level of thought they'll put in their ideas, then I think we benefit from that.
What could your future hold? More than you think. Because at Merrill Lynch, we work with you to create a strategy built around your priorities. Visit ml.com and learn more about Merrill Lynch, an affiliate of Bank of America. Merrill Lynch makes available products and services offered by Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer member, SIPC.
We talked about some of the unicorns before. We talked about This Ends Badly. I'm gonna skip those questions. Let me, before I get to Facebook, I have to ask a question. I love the show Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I know that Mike Judge and Alec Berg have described you as an unofficial writing consultant to this. So tell us about your experience with the show. And I have to, I'm a fan of Portlandia.
Mm-hmm, right.
And having been to Portland several times, I came away with the impression that, oh, this isn't a sitcom. It's
right.
a documentary.
Right.
How true is that for Silicon Valley?
That's my understanding. Portlandia is literally true, right?
It certainly feels that way.
It's just man on the street.
It's just, right.
You know, put a camera in front. Yes, exactly. So Silicon Valley is the exact same way. So I have to confess, I've still only seen the first season.
Get out!
I haven't seen the other
It's so
seasons.
Hilarious.
I know, I'm sure it is. The first season was so perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It was
You're
so
just going to stop.
I don't know. I've just had a mental block.
I haven't seen the one, from the most recent one this Sunday, and people are telling me it's just so hilarious and over the top.
Well, these guys are the funniest, the funniest
guys. And it just rings, especially being out here, it's like, oh, okay. I recognize him.
Yeah.
It rings really true. Do you ever get feedback from people saying, hey, what are you doing to us?
Excuse me?
Like, Mark, you're kind of making us look silly. What are you doing?
From who exactly?
Random people.
Random
people you know, other VCs, other founders, other because there are very few people come out of the show with their reputation intact.
Yeah, so that's the thing. I can't comment past the first season. I will say the first season was perfect, and I will tell you, so the secret of that show, at least the secret of the first season, which I consider a work of art, is Mike Judge himself started his career as a chip engineer in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And if you meet him, it's not what you'd expect. Like, he's one of the leading creative comedy geniuses of our era, and like the creator of all these, Beavis and Butthead and all these things. And
which is fascinating, because he started out so wildly overbroad, and Idiocracy, and you work your way down the list, and as he seems to have gotten older and maybe his artistic vision matured, it went from insane to overbroad to slapstick to, oh, this is mildly a parody and somewhat of cinema verite.
Although I think he'd argue Idiocracy was also a documentary.
It was a documentary, but 5 years ahead of its time. Right.
Exactly right. And so he has a very precise understanding actually of how things work here, more so than I think people would think.
Mm-hmm.
And it
comes across.
Yeah, and then his partners are also geniuses, and so it comes across. So that's good. I would also say, for people who haven't seen it, Halt and Catch Fire, in a completely different, 180 degree different mood. Mm-hmm. It's a dramatic. It's a drama. There's no
Halt and Catch
Halt
Fire.
Halt and Catch Fire is not funny at all. It's a very serious show. Halt and Catch Fire is a show on AMC that's, I think, in its third season now. It is a period piece. Silicon Valley is HBO. Silicon Valley is current time. Halt and Catch Fire is a period piece set in the early 80s at the birth of the PC. But it's the story. Basically, it's the fictionalized story of the creation of the company Compaq, and then the birth of the PC industry and the birth of the PC clone industry at a time when IBM was by far the dominant company in the industry, right? And so it's a spookily accurate portrayal of what a startup is actually like. And it's actually really funny. The critics of the show in the first season, it was getting criticized for being too melodramatic.
Uh-huh.
Like, this is all too superheated and too emotional. And I'm thinking, nope, it's like they put a camera in a startup.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
was real.
This is what they're actually like. I mean, everybody would like to, and this is also part of the thing we see all the time, is everybody wants to pretend that startups are fun, and it turns out startups are no fun.
No, it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And it is a stomach churning process. Of being told no by everybody and being told your idea is stupid. And it's just nonstop. You just feel like every startup founder, they just feel like they're under assault all day long. And so Halt and Catch Fire does a very good job of capturing the other side of that.
What about the incubators like Y Combinator or Backmonity? What about those where, all right, this is a little more founder-friendly environment with a little more support and a little less of that negative cascade that you were referring to?
Yeah, so they're fantastic. Look, they're fantastic. They've been hugely additive to the Valley. The big thing that Y Combinator and other firms like it are doing is they're bringing people in earlier. The path once upon a time, I mean, I was maybe an exception to this, but the path once upon a time was you go work, in a real job for 5 or 10 or 15 years and get real experience before you try one of these things, because you need to build the skill set. Basically, YC basically viewed as almost like the fifth year of college or something, where they have the ability to pull in, kids in a lot of cases are people who just haven't been exposed to startups and they basically try to spin them up much more quickly in their careers. And they talk openly about this, right? It's like it's sort of the new career path. It's also part of this increased Darwinian kind of feeding frenzy that we're talking about.
So as long as we throw enough competitors, gladiators into the ring, we'll end up with that many more survivors that potentially can be something one day.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of the impact that these things have are the companies that come out of them, you know, out of the programs. I suspect the long run effects, positive effects, will be even bigger, sort of the second, third, fourth generation, right? So the YC founders this year, right? The YC founders this year got, 150 companies in the batch right now or something like that. Like, you know, some of them are going to succeed. A lot of them are going to fail. But to me, that's almost beside the point because it's all the people in those companies. It's the 300-400 people who are working on those companies. And then what those people are going to do, not just this year, but 5 years from now and 10 years from now. And so these people are being set up on a career path where they should be able to do amazing things years from now.
One of the nice things about Silicon Valley is failure isn't considered a mark of shame. It's so this startup blew up and that startup didn't make it and we killed this, but we pivoted this one. And, you know, sometimes the fifth or sixth time is the charm.
Yeah, that's right. And so you get the first startup doesn't work. You do get more swings at the bat and by the way, you get different experiences. Like if your first startup doesn't work, it's very often that it ends in what's called an acqui-hire where you end up getting sold to a big company or some people just go and get a job just to recover from the trauma of going through a startup that doesn't work. But then you get skills, right? So then you have your startup experience. You have now experience maybe working at a great, you know, growth company where you're learning how stuff works when it's actually running at scale, right? And then 5-10 years, and you start to learn how to manage people and you sort of pick up these skills and then you go start another company, right? And so there is this sort of repeated swings at the bat kind of effect that happens. And I think that these incubators just give people basically an early swing at the bat that maybe otherwise didn't exist.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mark Andreessen discussing the unique structure of Andreessen Horowitz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My extra special guest today is Mark Andreessen. He is the co-founder and general partner of the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. He co-created the Mosaic Internet browser, co-founded Netscape, and has done more things over the past decade or two than most of us will do in our entire lifespans. Let's talk a little bit about the firm we're sitting in, which is quite lovely. It is a very relaxing Zen vibe here with the blonde wood and the just generally soothing atmosphere, not what you imagine when you think of the startup community and Silicon Valley. Tell us how you structured the firm and what was the thinking behind it.
Yeah, so the big thing, so we're trying to work with founders to create something out of nothing, right? And so with the time we invest in most companies, there's not a lot there. And then the path is going to be a 5, 10, 15-year path to get to, to get to something important and significant.
So you're really playing a very long game. It's not 2 years, hey, we got to start looking for an exit.
Yeah, it's I was with my friends at CNBC, right, have the show Fast Money, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm always pitching them, it's like you need the
slow money.
You need slow money, right? And the slow money should be on every day. And every day it should just be, right, you know, well, what's happened today that matters? And the answer is, yeah, nothing. You know, what's going on? You know, not much. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Right. And so, and you know, the startups are working incredibly hard. Like the startups, you know, there's all kinds of activity at the startups, but the investors, say the VCs who freak out on a daily, weekly, monthly basis with these companies, like burn themselves to a crisp, like because stuff, these companies are chaos. And so we go into it just knowing it's going to be, with every company, it's going to be this long running journey. And it just takes time. It takes at least 5 years to build something that has real value. And it takes at least 10 years to build something that's going to endure for another 10 years after that. And so it's just going to be this long thing. And then I mentioned earlier, like so much of this is people. Like we like to, I think, brag on like how good we are at thinking about the ideas and the tech and stuff. And we do spend a lot of time on that stuff. But I think a lot of it is partnering with really high potential people who in a lot of cases, you know, to your point, like don't have that much experience at the time they start their companies. Or even people with more career experience who haven't done a startup before, right? Where there's a whole new set of things they have to learn. And then we try to work and help them, you know, grow and become better and you know, develop the skills that they need to build important companies. And so the whole firm is kind of engineered around those ideas, right? So as an example, we will never back a startup if we think its outcome is it's going to get bought. Like every once in a while, it's
really
like if there's a slide in the deck that says exit strategy, you don't get bought by Google in 3 years, like for 10x, like
right.
We
won't, no good.
We won't fund the company. Mm-hmm. I could spend a lot of time on that, but like we're
so in other words, you want to create a company that worst case scenario exists on its own for the foreseeable decades in the future. And if someone happens to acquire them, great. Yeah. But that's not the target.
Well, that's the kicker is the companies that actually get bought are the ones that don't have to get bought. The ones that actually could have stood on their own, because those are the ones that actually
have value.
That's value, right, exactly. So that's the twist on the whole thing. But so we're always backing these companies with and these people with an eye towards long-run independence, developing something of deep and enduring value. So one is just the time frame. That's an important part. A second part is how we coach and mentor and work with the founders and the team that the founders build around them. And that has to do with how we select general partners for our firm, mm-hmm. or the people who pull the trigger on investments and go on the boards. And there is all our big claim to fame. There is all of our general partners are former founders and or CEOs of tech startups. And mm-hmm. so when we go on a board, it's always the case with us that you're sitting with somebody who has been through the same situation that you're in right now and mm-hmm. has had to make the difficult decision and has had to live with the consequences of that decision.
Right.
Right. And so it's a grounding in the advice and the guidance that you get that I think just goes deeper than, you know, and there are, by the way, there are great VCs who have no operating experience or little operating experience. And mm-hmm. some of them are actually very, very good investors, but there's just so much in that intimate relationship with the founder and with the team that I think benefits from having the credibility from having actually been in that
situation
before.
You guys also do something unique in that every partner is on every investment, as opposed to you do software, you do semiconductor, I'll do this. Every partner participates in every investment. Is that an accurate statement?
So we do. There is always a single GP on the board, so there mm-hmm. is somebody who's focused on you. But then the way the firm is structured is everybody shares equally in the results of that. So basically, there's a lot of things we've done in the firm to design the firm to be a zero politics environment, to be mm-hmm. So what you discover.
Zero politics environment.
Well, zero politics environment with respect to how the entrepreneurs, I can't mm-hmm. guarantee we've ruled out all politics in the firm. I'm just saying, as far as the founders experience it, they should never run into, let me back up for a second.
It shouldn't be this guy in the firm likes this, but this guy is fighting against it.
So what you often find in a lot of venture capital firms is they present as united front, and then there's a tremendous amount of infighting that's taking place. And, mm-hmm. and it's, by the way, it's the same thing you see on Wall Street a lot. Like mm-hmm. it's just, for example, there's just a battle for there's a battle for the profits. Like there's a battle for the carry. And so for me to get more money, somebody else has to get less money. Mm-hmm. And that leads to this weird adverse thing where I actually want the other guy's deals to fail, because then I'll have more negotiating leverage in my comp, you know, discussion. Mm-hmm. Or there'll be a battle between who wins the deal, right? Maybe the entrepreneur starts the conversation with one GP, but maybe the entrepreneur really would rather have another GP with a more relevant skill set, right? Mm-hmm. In the same firm on their board.
Sure.
At a lot of firms, that starts World War III internally. At our firm,
I can imagine.
Everybody's fine with that. Another thing, a little twist that we have, we don't have a promotion path in the firm to general partner. So the way most other firms are structured is they have young people in the firm who get promoted up the ranks right. over time, but it's a competitive process, right? So you'll have 20 junior people who are competing for, you know, six sort of junior GP slots, who are competing for two senior GP slots mm-hmm. over the course of 10 or 15 years. And so they're in a constant knife fight with each other, right? Because it's just like at a law firm.
I was going to say, it sounds like the big Wall Street or yeah. Park Avenue law firms, where it's yeah. just a bloodbath.
Yeah.
And when they make the announcements of partners, there's a handful of happy people and a lot of other people getting their resumes together, and it's no fun for anyone. Yeah.
And so when that structure, that's exactly right. So when that structure works well, it leads to a very brutally Darwinian effective eat what you kill environment, where mm-hmm. you're basically breeding sharks for maximum effectiveness. The problem is, as a client of one of those firms, you get caught crosswise in the politics,
sure.
right? And you do not get, you basically only get access to the people who have the direct incentive to help you in the firm. You don't get access to the rest of the firm. And that's the typical experience that founders have with VCs, which is they get promised the resources of the firm. They get what they get in practice as one person.
That seems really counterproductive.
Right. It's very counterproductive. And our by the way, a lot of our work with companies is working with our companies to help them resolve these kinds of issues with the other VCs. So
because you guys are also co-investors with other venture capital.
So we just don't, and again, like this may work for other firms, we just decided to take a different mentality where we don't have that kind of, you never get caught in that kind of crossfire because it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So that's a big thing. And then the other big thing that we do as a firm is we do believe deeply in the idea that the founders, not in every case, but in a lot of cases, really should be able to, if they want to, and if they're able to do it, they should run their own companies. And we could have a long conversation about that. The other thing that we do is we really try to help arm up the founders who don't have a lot of deep business experience with mm-hmm. all of the connectivity, the network access that the professional CEOs all tend to have. Mm-hmm. So the technical founder starts a company, right? And then, you know, a big part of it is, are they just going to be good at managing and leading, which is where the GP relationship is really critical. It's mm-hmm. coaching and mentoring.
Do you find that very often engineers and people with that sort of technical skill set, the stereotype is they're socially awkward, they lack the usual skill set that a CEO typically has.
Yeah. So that is often the case, but also the reverse is often the case, which is the highly social, you know, the CEOs had a central casting, they have, you know, the inevitably great hair and the, you know, brilliant smiles and the great, you know, they look great in a suit in front of a crowd. They often, not always, but they often lack the technical grounding to be able to determine the direction of a technology company. And so, and again, like these are stereotypes and they're overly broad, but they are patterns.
There is some truth to it.
There's some
stereotypes
truth to it.
For a reason.
In this case. And so what we're now, everything, I would say the kicker, everything in venture is on an exception basis, right? And so by definition, we're not looking for the pattern, we're looking for the exception. And so we're looking for the very particular technical founder who, by the way, may start out without a lot of these social skills. Mm-hmm. It may start out without really knowing how to deal with customers, or may start out not really knowing how to manage people or hire people. And then if they're willing and able to learn, we will then put a lot of effort into helping them become great at those things. By the way, it's the same as true on the other side. When it comes time, some of our companies, we do end up with professional CEOs, and then we look for the professional CEOs that not only have that skill, but also then go deep on products and technology. And so and those are both exceptions. Like these are not on both sides. These are rare people.
So it makes me wonder, is it easier to take someone who has the technical skills and teach them to be a CEO? Because it sounds like it's challenging to take a CEO and say, by the way, on the side, we want you to get your, your MS in computer science over at Stanford at night. That doesn't seem like that's...
And invent your first breakthrough product.
Right, at the same time. I would think it's easier to teach the inexperienced, unskilled, but really sophisticated technologist the people skills, then vice versa.
So in the tech industry, we firmly believe exactly what you said. The general pattern is we want to find the great technical founder and help them become a great CEO. And that, and exactly to your point, that's easier than finding a great CEO and trying to turn them into a great product strategist and technology visionary. And I think the history of our industry confirms this. Like 9 out of 10, roughly, of the big successful tech companies in the last, frankly, 100 years have been run by their founders for long periods of time for this reason, starting with Hewlett-Packard and Intel and, you know, many, many, many others. You know, now today, Facebook and Google, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing. Now, because it's easier, though, doesn't mean it's easy, right? And so, you know, it is a real, like, for these people to learn and grow, you know, for an engineer who has not managed a large organization before to learn how to do that, like, that's a big thing that they really have to really want to do it. Mm-hmm. And some of them just simply don't. And then you pair them up with somebody, you then come up with a pair configuration where they can work with somebody who can help them with that. And then some of them just simply can't, right? Mm-hmm. They just hit the wall where it's just not something that they're going to be able to do. And so therein lies the difficulty of implementing the theory, but that's what we do.
So two things immediately come to mind when you bring that up. The first is you have Larry and Sergey, who are technologists who eventually partner up with their chairman, Eric Schmidt, who basically brings them along and teaches them how to be CEOs or co-CEOs or whatever we want to call them. But the other example that leaps to mind is Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. So let's talk about that for a moment. You're a friend of his, you're a mentor. Tell us how that relationship came about, and how have you helped Zuckerberg become one of the leading CEOs in the world?
So first of all, I should disclaim most credit on this, which is Mark has done most of this on his own.
Okay.
And he has been advised and helped along the way by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to take any sort of giant credit on this one. I did get to see it, and I did get to be in the room for a fair amount of it. So I met Mark through Peter Thiel after he first invested in the company, and this was when Facebook was 4 or 5 people sitting in beanbags in Palo Alto in an office with very colorful graffiti on the walls in the very early days. And it was just crystal clear from the start. I mean, it was not, I don't think, clear that Facebook was going to become, you know,
a behemoth.
How often does that ever happen, and how can you actually predict that?
Do you want me to go through the list of how often that's happened with you, or should we save that for a later segment?
Not very freaking often, I can tell you that. So I will say, like, it was very clear from the beginning that Mark was I call him a learning machine. He just siphons in information, and this goes to what I mentioned earlier. It's with technical founders. It's both can they do it, but also do they want to do it? And a big part of that for both of those is can they learn. And by the way, there are people who just simply hit the wall where they just do not want to learn anymore.
Right.
Like, and we've all dealt with people like that, where sure. It's just like they're impervious to new information, right? Because they've deliberately set themselves up where it's like any new information at this point would be a threat. And so I'm done.
They tap out and
yeah.
They're finished.
They peaked. Like they've just peaked in terms of everything that they're ever going to know and absorb. Like that's just the way that they've decided to live their lives. And so to do what Mark has done, you need to be the exact opposite of that. You need to just constantly be pulling in new information.
Intellectually curious, devouring whatever comes across
every possible topic that you can imagine that's going to be relevant to what you're doing. And so Mark has just been, the way I think of Mark is he's the most systematic person I think I've ever worked with at just extracting the information. And that was true when he was really young, right, and was not well known. And he was very, determined to go get the information from people who knew. And then it's only magnified out as he's grown. And by the way, he's out on this tour right now, touring all 50 states. Like from Mark's standpoint, there's all kinds of speculation on that. But from Mark's standpoint, the whole purpose of that is learning.
Like not that he's running for president when he turns 35.
He swears not. But his whole, when he talks about that, like when he talked about that with us, when he said he's going to go do it, it's all, I'm going to go learn. I'm going to go learn about the country. I'm going to go learn about every state. I'm going to learn about people who aren't like me. And for me, it was not surprising in the sense of it's completely consistent with how he operates. And I think this is an area in which he's a real role model on this. Like I really think I think a lot of founders like look at Mark and they try to drive like, how do I get good at, I don't know, viral marketing or da da da, whatever product running.
He just wants to take it all in.
I think if more people just looked at Mark and said, how do I learn like that? I think they would be much better.
You're on the board of directors of Facebook. What's the reaction when the CEO and founder says, hey guys, I'm going around the country. I'm going to go to all 50 states because I think people have interesting things to say, and I want to learn. Is there eyebrows raised, or it's like, oh, that's just Mark being Mark, go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, Mark does things like that. Mark has always stretched himself. Like, he stretches. He comes up with a quest every year. Calls it his quest.
A
quest.
A couple of years ago, I remember he was learning some obscure language, if memory serves. Yeah, I don't remember what it was.
Mandarin.
Mandarin, yeah. Right. well, not so obscure, but a complex language. So he does a quest every year and just basically keeps learning.
Yeah, and he's been doing this, I don't know, for 10 years now or something. And so he's been through a variety of things. And he talks about this. He's very open about this. He just goes out and siphons. And so he's a guy who's literally able to learn from some of the most experienced and accomplished people in the world on certain topics. But spend a day on a farm not far from where I grew up in Wisconsin and learn how to milk cows. Like, and he's just as far
and
as
he's happy to do
like,
that.
He's thrilled. He's absolutely thrilled.
Really?
Yeah, 100%.
So he's living the life he always wants to live. I just want to just suck everything I can possibly into my head.
Yeah.
As rapidly as I possibly can.
Yep.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. Let's keep going about the deal days you do. I want to talk about some more of the combination angel investing late stage. So you do deal days, and how many people will the firm see in a given day or week when those are running?
Well, we have, like I say, we do about 2,000 a year total. So then there's a whole funnel, there's a whole system, and there's a lot of people in the firm who meet companies and the whole process of kind of distilling the information. So it's, it's dozens a week, kind of across the firm. And then we see pitches on usually Monday and Thursday generally, as the GP team. And that's, on Monday it was five this week. On Thursday, I think there's two or three more.
And this is every week. So
yeah, every week.
There's occasional vacations and stuff, but pretty much you're running through 300, 400 pitches the GPs will see every year.
And these are what we call the all GP pitches. And so these are the ones where everybody's in the room. And then there's many others that happen during the week where one or two or three GPs might see them. Right.
So it's a giant funnel. It shrinks down and down and out of those, let's call it 300 a year, you're looking at 10% very, very seriously.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And when you decide to do an investment in them, are these usually angel $50,000 rounds, or are these much more substantial rounds, or both?
Yeah, so we don't really do the $50,000 anymore. We used to do more of those when we got started, but we don't do those. We tend to get much more. We tend to kind of go all in or not,
right?
and I could go through that, but like that.
Sure,
that's
why not?
How we work.
Well, why all in? Why not? Well, we'll get two or three other investors, and we'll hedge our bets and go in partially.
Well, there are a couple reasons. One is just the level of an economic thing, which is for us to be the opportunity. So there's cost, and then there's opportunity cost, and so there's always opportunity cost on our time and on our ability. How many companies can we work with? And so,
is it more the time or the money?
It's more the time. It's more the opportunity cost. It's every deal we do fills a slot that can't be then filled by another 100 deals that you might have done instead. Right. And so there's always the any deal you do, there's a big risk that you're foreclosing some other deal that would have been much better. And so you have to just think very hard about it. It's time. That's a big part of it. Then there's also just the economics of it, which is just as a consequence of that, when you have a hit, like how much of it you actually own actually really drives your returns.
Right.
And so we have a responsibility to our, to our LPs to try to, really have the hits pay off. And then part of it is just a full engagement model. Like, we really don't like giving up. There are venture firms that if your company's not going well, they'll mysteriously vanish off the VC firm's website. Like, they just never get talked. They get dropped down the memory hole. We don't tend to do that. Comes from the fact we've all been founders and CEOs. Like, we don't tend to give up.
Know what it's like when you're on the receiving end of unreturned phone calls.
That is right. Yeah. And so, my view is like, we make our money on the ones that work, and I think make our reputations on the ones that don't.
That's a fascinating line right there, because the math behind venture investing is, look, when you go out and buy stocks in the market, 50 of them will do nothing, 30 of them will work, and 10 of them will be disasters, and a handful of them will work really well. The odds are far more daunting with venture investing. It's almost 10x that. You have, and I think you've written this elsewhere, you'll make 100 investments and 50 of them just crash. Yep. 20, 30 do okay, but it's the one or two at the top of the pyramid that pay for the other 99.
Pay for the whole thing, right, exactly. And that's actually roughly the math. So 50% in top-tier venture capital, top decile venture capital across 40 years of data on this, which we have access to a couple different ways. Basically, half the deals. The good news is it's not a 10% success rate. It's a 50% success rate, right? So it's not as bad as some people think, but it is a 50% success rate, meaning it's a 50% failure rate.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning
50% failure rate, meaning zero return on that half.
Of the 50%, about 25%, about half of the 50% go to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other half returns between 0 and 1x.
Okay.
So they recover some capital, but not all the invested capital.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sort of that third quartile of sort of 50 to 75%, they return, 1 to 3x. And then it's basically the upper quartile that returns sort of, God willing, returns 3x plus.
Right.
And then
some of the 3x plus is a lot more plus than 3x.
Yeah. So that's the good news. The bad news is, you do get the ones where you lose 1x pretty frequently. The good news is if they work, they can make 1,000x, right? And so then the LP, this is the great thing about kind of the venture ecosystem, the LPs don't care. So, for example, in the data, they don't care how you make the money, just as long as you do. So that in the data, for example, the top performing venture firms strike out more often, called the Babe Ruth effect.
Right.
The top performing firms have more zeros. Right, they're only swinging for home runs, and by definition in venture, if you're only swinging for home runs, you're taking more risk on crazier ideas.
Makes sense.
And it's like Kleiner Perkins famously, their Google fund, it was the fund that had Google and it had Segway,
right,
and Segway was a legendary disaster and got all this negative publicity, and they lost 1x their money on Segway,
right?
Guess how much money they made on Google, right?
Untold
10,000x, right. And so the good news on it is we and this is something that we're the U.S. in particular has a real edge on this, I think, is we have a base of limited partners, institutional investors in the U.S. that deeply understand that this is how it works. And so when we have one that goes to zero, they don't call us up and yell at us and complain. They're like, yeah, that's a cost of doing business.
Right.
And in fact, we've had LPs ask us why we actually don't have more failures. Like, are you taking enough risk?
Really?
What they want to know is, okay, of the companies that are working, how well are they working? And basically, we call this the how high is up question.
How high is up?
How big could they get?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then literally in venture, if you were lucky enough in venture to come back every year with one big giant home run and all the rest are failures, they'd be totally happy.
They
would not complain about that at all. Which, of course, is very, very different than how the rest of Wall Street operates.
No doubt.
Right.
Do you run into, every time there's that 1,000x, do you run into... How many times do people say, well, this is the next Facebook? No, please stop saying that. Do you sort of end up in that mode where whatever was working, hey, let me explain to you why our company is the next XYZ. Do these cliches begin to make you crazy?
Yeah, they do. Well, they're a tip. They usually, the really great founders tend not to say that.
I hope people are listening to all these suggestions. This is going to be a how to pitch Andreessen Horowitz. Don't go there without having heard all these suggestions from this guy named Mark Andreessen. Yeah. I would imagine that at a certain point, halfway through a pitch, do you look at each other and like, all right, we're done with this?
Every once in a while. I will say every once in a while. But I will say this, the privilege of the job is these are 2,000 of the smartest people in the world in the mm-hmm. domains in which they're operating, who we get to deal with every year. And so the other side, we learn so much, even in deals we're not gonna do it. There's some where we just made a mistake and we've seen a pitch that we shouldn't have seen because mm-hmm. we're never gonna do the deal for some reason. And there's a dozen reasons why that could be the case. You generally learn just a lot of contextual information about what's happening in that industry, because these people have, to get to that point, they've all thought these things through really deeply.
Right.
Back to the idea maze thing we were talking about.
So that's
you learn in the by the way, what you experience is just a fire hose of it's just the smartest people in the world coming in and spending an hour telling you everything they know. Like, it's an amazing experience.
How that was a question. Next question is, how big of a strategic advantage is getting first looks at 2,000 of the smartest people in the world?
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it. And I mean, that's why I've sort of become kind of semi-legendary sort of optimist. Mm-hmm. It's really hard, I think, to be pessimistic in this job, because you do see all these incredibly fired up people with all these incredibly vivid and brilliant ideas. And you get a sense of the productive capacity of capitalism, of the intellectual pursuits. By the way,
it's hard to be too negative when you're looking at the most optimistic inventions in the universe.
That's right. And by the way, also the output of the great research universities. Like, so mm-hmm. much of what we do is building off, you mentioned earlier, so much of what we do is building off what happens to Stanford and MIT and Berkeley and all these other schools. Mm-hmm. And it's just crystal clear, like, how amazing they are.
So that's sort of
the psychic payoff from the job, is the ability to do that. And then it just also, I think, just becomes clear, like, there are, contra all the, the headlines are just all relentlessly negative these days, there are a lot of smart people in the world. There are a lot of people with a lot of energy in the world who legitimately want to build new things.
Mm-hmm. That's very exciting.
And increasingly, not just here, right? Not just in Silicon Valley, not just in the U.S., not just in the West, all over the world, mm-hmm. right? And so that's the other side of it, is this culture of entrepreneurship is really spreading. And, we're going to benefit from that in the sense of more opportunities, but I think the entire world's going to benefit from that.
So you're focused mostly here on the West Coast, primarily Silicon Valley. You're not looking at China, you're not looking at India. Is that a fair observation?
So all of our companies want to be multinationals, and so all of our companies want to operate on the ground in all these countries, and all of our companies hire a huge number of immigrants. And mm-hmm. so our companies, by definition, all end up with a lot of Chinese immigrant and Indian immigrant. And then, by the way, a lot of them are actually build offices on the ground. Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of companies with offices in China, building out big presences, India, these other countries. So we're heavily exposed to the sort of knowledge flow and talent that way. Mm-hmm. We do think venture capital is a craft. There is a craft to the business.
Sure.
And it's a lot of it's the relationship with the board members and the founders and the team. And so there's a local dynamic to it. The number of venture firms that have successfully figured out how to operate in multiple geographies and stay world class, it's a very short list. Mm-hmm. Most generally that doesn't work. And so we've made a decision, at least for the time being, to try to be really good in Silicon Valley.
And
by the way, we do fund companies outside the Valley, but just on an exception basis. Like, they have to be super special. And we do have some of those.
So you focus mostly local. You're a software absolutist. No clean tech, no rocket ships, no electric cars. Is that still true? It's software and software only?
So software at the core. So the rule is software at the core. So there has to be, we just think there's a particular magic around software. There's a particular magic around how you can create things with software, right? I call it alchemy. Like, you type on a keyboard and then things happen in the real world. Like, that mm-hmm. that's an amazing process. There's just kind of huge intellectual leverage there. And then as a consequence, there's huge economic leverage, right? Which is, software is labor that creates capital.
It's
the closest thing to magic we'll ever have. It's mm-hmm. like typing on the keyboard is like casting a spell, and then something happens, right? It's like, the Lyft guys, they type software, and then all of a sudden, real people are being taken on real rides in real cars, like, just by magic. Like, just the software just caused that to happen. And so we are looking for that kind of software leverage, the sort of software magic in every company.
Scalable, magical, and the ability to convert labor into capital.
And then as a consequence of that, our companies do end up doing all kinds of different things. And so mm-hmm. we have some companies that sell software. We have some companies that provide software as a service. We have some companies that provide apps. We have some companies that are making hardware. We have some companies that are going after new healthcare pursuits in biology, material science. Like, there's lots of software is becoming so intertwined with the world.
Right.
That there are lots of ways to now use it to leverage it in different spaces. And so the range of companies that we're funding is broader than ever, but they all have software at the core.
Software at the core. I started out this segment talking about the firm. There's a couple of things I have to ask about the firm because I'm fascinated by it. So you used to blog at PMarca, and let me remind you that I warn you to pace yourself, young man. You're going to burn yourself out. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
And you tweet fairly actively. I know we're on hiatus now. And you podcast. You guys have a podcast room at... This doesn't sound like it's the typical forms of communication for the old line venture capital firm. I mean, everybody has a website, and there's sort of this interesting, hey, here are all the things we passed on that we shouldn't have. Right. It's sort of this, I guess we could call it humility or attempt at humility. Your gestalt is very different here. Tell me about the thinking behind that.
Yeah, so we're trying to teach. Like we view ourselves kind of as being fundamentally lucky to have seen a lot of these things. Most of these things we're trying to teach. We think it's, by the way, to our benefit to teach, because if more people know how to do this, then there's more companies for us to fund and people for us to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And then part of it is just, look, I think technology has gotten very important in the world, much more than it used to be. And so, and it's complex and it's hard to understand. And so I think, and it's hard to understand from the outside. And so a big part of just what we're trying to do is to tell the story of what's happening. Not just in our firm, but tell the story of what's happening in the industry and what's happening with all these companies and with the implications of all these technologies. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned our podcast series. So I get no credit for that. Our partners here have done all the work on that. But it's become, like, I would say, shockingly, amazingly important and influential among people who care about how technology is affecting
the
world. The level of response we've gotten to that has been like an order of magnitude beyond what I would have ever thought was possible.
Amazing thing is, a couple of years ago, people saying, well, podcast is all but over. I just read last week, Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn is now hosting a podcast. So this is a technology that, A, is not going away as a form of communication. What is the benefit to the firm of being able to go out and tell a story that might not be, hey, here's why you should use Andreessen Horowitz? It's never that overt. It's always... Here's some interesting things happening in the world of technology you should know about.
Here's what's happening. A lot of people care about this stuff. A lot of people care about the implications. A lot of people, by the way, are in a position to affect the world, and you know, regulators and journalists and people at big companies. And so we're trying to get to all the people who are decision makers, you know, the constituents in the entire ecosystem that have to cope with the consequences of technological change, trying to get to those folks. We're trying to pull more people into the industry, right? If more people all over the world have a sense of what's happening, then they can decide they might want to participate. We're trying to help people up-level their skills, become more knowledgeable about these things. And we obviously benefit from all that, but just more broadly, like, I think this is the topic of our time.
It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, so we're almost out of time. There's a ton of questions I didn't get to, including the speed round, but what I really want to do is get to the standard questions. So how many minutes can we go over? 2 minutes.
Yeah.
That's going to be tough. All right, so by the way, if I forget to say this, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and going through such thoughtful, detailed answers. These have really been fascinating. I have 10 favorite questions. I'm going to just go through two or three of them really quickly. Tell us something about your background that most people don't know.
I'm probably a big one. I grew up in the rural Midwest. I grew up in Trump country.
You did?
Yes, absolutely.
And has that affected your output on the world at all, 100%. Your outlook?
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Early mentors?
Jim Clark, Jim Barksdale were the two big ones. And I'd say very complementary personalities. They work together very well, but also starkly different in their skill sets and orientations. And I learned a lot from both of them.
The question I get from listeners more than anyone, ask your guests what their favorite books are.
Favorite book. So I have three quick nominations, and I'm getting the hook here. Poor Charlie's Almanac, the compendium
Charlie
Munger's speeches. Mm-hmm. I think is tremendous. Extreme Ownership has been a favorite recent book by a guy named Jocko Willink, who's a former Navy SEAL commander. Extreme Ownership. One of the best books on leadership I've ever read, and a tremendous, by the way, war story book as well. Man, there are so many. There's a brand new book. Robert Sapolsky has a new book I've just started on human behavior. It's sort of his magnum opus on human behavior. He's the great evolutionary theorist. And so that would probably be the third one. That's the new one, but it looks very exciting.
And then our final question, what is it that you know about technology and venture capital investing today that you wish you knew 25 plus years ago when you were first starting out?
Oh, there are no bad ideas. There are only early ideas.
No bad ideas, just early ideas.
They'll all happen. It'll all happen. I've become convinced now it'll all happen. Every smart person who comes in here with a crazy idea, it's all going to happen at some point. They all happen. It's just a question of when.
We have been speaking with Mark Andreessen of Andreessen Horowitz. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out all our other such chats. You can find them on SoundCloud, Apple iTunes, and Bloomberg.com. I would be remiss if I did not thank our hosts, Mark Andreessen and the crew here at Andreessen Horowitz, as well as Mike Batnick, who is my head of research and helped put these questions together. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Our world is always moving. So with Merrill Lynch, you can get access to financial guidance online, in person, or through the app. Visit ml.com and learn more about Merrill Lynch, an affiliate of Bank of America. Merrill Lynch makes available products and services offered by Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer member SIPC.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.